Good morning, Bill Lynch with the CBS World News Roundup. The pace of U.S.-Soviet relations is moving at a furious rate this morning. Moments ago, the Soviet news agency TASS announced in Moscow that Kremlin leader Mikhail Gorbachev and President Reagan will meet on October 11th and 12th in Reykjavik, Iceland. The plan had been for Gorbachev to come to the United States. That apparently has changed. We've received no official confirmation yet from Washington. At this hour, Secretary of State Schultz is at the White House, and Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze is at his United Nations mission in New York, each preparing to brief reporters with his country's version of the face-saving deal that won the release yesterday of American reporter Nicholas Danilov. As they speak, accused Soviet spy Gennady Zakharov is in a Brooklyn federal courthouse, apparently awaiting his release. After his uncomfortable month as a pawn on the superpower chessboard, Nicholas Danilov is now on a plane for home. CBS News correspondent Derek Blakely watched as Danilov left Frankfurt.
Nicholas Danilov has now begun the final leg on his journey back to the United States. Before he departed for the airport this morning, Danilov waved to reporters gathered outside the Consul General's home where he spent the night, and he told them he felt just fine. Later, he flashed the V for Victory sign as he headed for the airport. Accompanied by U.S. officials, Danilov and his wife, Ruth, boarded a scheduled flight bound for Washington. That flight has now departed, and they're due to arrive in the nation's capital later this afternoon. Derek Blakely, CBS News, Frankfurt.
The Danilov case is being viewed very differently in the Soviet Union, as we hear now from Wyatt Andrews.
This is Wyatt Andrews in Moscow. The West might celebrate the freedom of Nick Danilov, but in the Soviet Union, it's as if last night's release never happened. On Soviet television, the Danilov release was specifically omitted when the newscaster began to read a list of meetings held by Foreign Minister Shevardnadze at the United Nations in New York. Secretary of State Schultz did not make the list, and there was no mention of Danilov's freedom. For the moment, the Soviet policy is silence, but there are promises that will change. This morning, Shevardnadze hosts a press conference in New York, and tonight, the Soviet people will hear an important announcement on television. Whatever the Soviet announcement, whether it's about Danilov or the chance of a Soviet-American summit, it's likely that Danilov's reputation as a spy, at least in the eyes of the Soviet public, will be perpetuated. In the only newspaper mention of Danilov this morning, one commentator repeats Soviet accusations that Danilov had connections to the CIA. Again, no mention of Danilov's release. But the point seems to be that despite Danilov's unconditional freedom, the Soviets have too much at stake in the public position that Danilov is guilty. Wyatt Andrews, CBS News, Moscow.
We are still awaiting official Washington confirmation of that TASS report of an October summit in Iceland between President Reagan and General Secretary Gorbachev. We will bring it to you as we receive it. A major underground nuclear test is scheduled in less than an hour at the Nevada test site. In nearby Las Vegas, former President Carter yesterday criticized President Reagan for refusing to join the unilateral Soviet test ban, and he denounced the Reagan Star Wars missile defense program as a trillion-dollar boondoggle. In what's seen as a move toward eventual retirement from South African politics, President P.W. Botha today stepped down after 2 decades as a provincial leader of his ruling National Party. Last night, the 70-year-old Botha announced he would not call a general election this year, as aides had been hinting. Botha also scored a legal victory today as the nation's highest court upheld key state of emergency provisions under which thousands have been detained. In Washington, the Senate is shortly expected to repudiate President Reagan's veto of the tough South Africa sanctions bill. The House voted 313-83 last night to override, as Ike Pappas reports.
More Republicans voted against sustaining the president's veto of the South African sanctions bill than voted for it, a reflection of the half-hearted effort the White House made in the Democratic-controlled House. Even Republican leaders felt the president should have tried harder, Minority Leader Bob Michael.
To put it in the mildest possible terms, the administration has been less than brilliant in handling this issue. But just because the administration has not provided inspired leadership doesn't mean we can accept the package before us.
The president has been counting on getting the Republican-controlled Senate to sustain his veto, killing the congressional sanctions move. As Mr. Reagan campaigned for Senate candidates in the Midwest, he sent a letter to Capitol Hill yesterday promising to add new restrictions to the limited sanctions he issued last year. But Democrats are warning that if the override drive is stopped now, tougher sanctions could lie ahead next year. Among other things, the congressional sanctions ban new American business investments in South Africa and forbid South Africa from using U.S. banks. The Senate is expected to vote on the override matter by tomorrow. Ike Pappas, CBS News, Capitol Hill.
At midnight tonight, bureaucrats ring in the fiscal new year, but once again, Congress will not have completed action on a more than half-trillion-dollar 1987 money bill. To tide the government over and prevent federal shutdowns, emergency measures will have to be enacted. In the Philippines last night, military intelligence agents arrested Rodolfo Salas, identified as the commander-in-chief of the communist rebel New People's Army. Also picked up outside a Manila hospital were Salas's wife and driver. Lawyers for the communist-led National Democratic Front demanded Salas's immediate release and charged the military brass ordered the arrests to head off peace talks between the communists and the Aquino government. Secretary of State George Shultz had just begun briefing reporters in the White House briefing room in Washington. He announced that accused Soviet spy Gennady Zakharov has been allowed to plead no contest in Brooklyn federal court, and also that Soviet dissidents, including Yuri Orlov, will be released. Let's now join the Shultz briefing.
1977, for alleged anti-Soviet activity. The Helsinki Monitors, a courageous group of human rights activists, openly attempted to hold the Soviet authorities accountable to their commitments under the Helsinki Accords of 1975. They maintained direct contact with Western diplomats and journalists in an effort to keep them informed of Soviet human rights abuses. Such well-known figures as Andrei Sakharov, Yelena Bonner, and Anatoly Sharansky participated in the Moscow-Helsinki Monitoring Group, and similar groups modeled on the Moscow example sprang up in other major Soviet cities. Orlov was a founding member and driving force behind the Helsinki Monitors. As chairman of the Moscow group, he singled himself out for particular attention from the KGB and was caught up in the first wave of arrests of group members. In 1978, he was sentenced to 7 years in a strict regime labor camp and 5 years of internal exile. Since 1984, he has been forced to live in a remote Siberian village in extremely harsh physical conditions. At age 62, Orlov is in extremely poor health as a result of prolonged periods of solitary confinement, up to 6 months at a time, in labor camp, and severe beatings suffering both in camp and in exile. Orlov's wife, Irina Valitova, shared his commitment to the Helsinki process. She has maintained regular contact with Western embassies and journalists over the years since her husband's arrest, and has steadfastly worked to ameliorate the harsh conditions of his confinement.